Okay, so we'll just roll, yeah? Okay. So, welcome, Mohammed and Omo and Nero. I didn't think we'd make it. I thought we had COVID, nuclear warfare threat, strikes, and some my schedule. So I'm actually really pleased that we finally managed to get you guys together. And thank you so much for giving your time. Just to, by means of introduction, who I am. So I'm Fareed. I am the Fareed Iqbal. I'm the Sergi's CEO and founder. We're a company based in London. And our whole focus is on building technologies that improve the outcome of cancer, namely colorectal cancer. And we'll talk about a bit later what sort of technologies we have built. And we were very keen to sort of move away from just supplying services and technologies to actually understanding sort of the core issue that what we're trying to deal with our technologies. And we thought, well, how better way to do it than to bring the people at the forefront who are on this journey with us, the fight towards this sort of disease that we fight every day, and actually take it from or represent those opinions from the people who have lived those experiences. So if by means of a quick introduction as to who you guys are, perhaps Mo first, an introduction of who you are and a bit of your background, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I'm Mo Hack. I'm here as a patient who's gone through bowel cancer. I was diagnosed when I was 31, which was in 2014. And so we're now in 2022 and I'm 39. So I was diagnosed with a stage 4 bowel cancer and my doctor said I had a small chance of success. And so we'll share my story later, but I'm here to kind of see what it's like going through the illness and to still be alive all these years later. And it's an honor to always share my story and help the cause that you started off describing.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing that story. And Nero, yourself, your you could present.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Nuri Rajendran. I'm a colorectal surgeon at Queen's Hospital in King George's, so BHR, NHS Trust, and I'm the colorectal lead there and have a place on the Alliance as sort of an early diagnostic lead for colorectal cancer.
Excellent. So I guess let's start by really dumbing down, you know, what is it that we're talking about? So perhaps, Nero, you could shine some light on when we say colorectal cancer or colorectal, what do we mean by that?
So we're really talking about the specific part of the anatomy. We're talking about the colon and the rectum. So not the whole bowel, but just the lower bowel. And also sometimes the anus as well. So any sort of cancers that can occur there are, if picked up early enough, operable. And if it's picked up early enough, can have quite good outcomes. The challenge is actually picking them up and making a successful sort of screening program. And there are difficulties because it's not the most socially acceptable form of screening, having a colonoscopy at all. I think in terms of previously, I think perhaps it was more thought of as a disease that's purely for the elderly part of the population. And we know now that's certainly not true, and certainly going forward, it seems to be something that has an increasing presentation even in younger patients. So we're certainly seeing more and more of it in patients under 50. Mm-hmm. So that's one issue. I think the other thing, in terms of ways of treatment, I guess we'll come on to that later, but I think in terms of pickup, predominantly it's been done by endoscopy. We're always looking for more socially acceptable ways to try and pick up and screen patients for this. And things like FIT tests have come up a lot recently, which is a different type of test for poo, to look for blood, and to diagnose if people have got a higher chance of having a colorectal cancer or any other sort of bowel disease that might need treatment as well. So I think that's something that's really come about much more since COVID. I think it was initially there to try and stratify or to sort of protect the resources of the NHS and just make sure the high-risk patients got their test. But now I think it's being used more as an adjunct, so on top of people having symptoms that worry the GP or themselves. Again, if they have a fit test that comes back positive, it's an additional factor that gets taken into account, and they get hopefully sent to us to be tested.
Mm-mm. Now, Mo, you're an expert now on what colorectal means. If we pan back to when you were first diagnosed, did you even know about colorectal anatomy, that you can get cancers there? Were you aware of this disease state?
Yeah, so I had very little knowledge on cancers in general. If I'd heard the word colorectal, I probably wouldn't have known what that means. And, you know, there are other terms like colon and bowel, which I would have been aware of, but not from a illness disease perspective. You know, so it completely came as a shock with no knowledge of what was ahead of me.
And from the sort of the journey you've been on, do you think that lack of awareness within sort of your age group is it mirrors what you went through in terms of that unawareness of a cancer within that region and that region generally? Do you think from the similar stories you've heard?
Yes. So what commonly would have come up is the whole idea of irritable bowel disease. So if you have any like stomach or gut related problems, you know, it's easy to say it's IBS or IBD, and you know, cancer would be very far off. But just that whole notion of having a stomach problem, you know, I call it stomach, but now I know the stomach wasn't necessarily the issue. It's, we're talking about the intestines, right? But you know, I'd be in meetings and I'd have pain in my abdomen, where I'd have to get up and just pace around to relieve myself. And if that didn't work, I'd need to go to the toilet. And, you know, my colleagues were like, what's wrong? Like, and I didn't know what was wrong. It turned out to be stage 4 bowel cancer. But another issue is my pain became visible in that I couldn't bear the pain at work, at home. But prior to that, no one would know, because it's a stomach issue. Like, it's not something I'd ordinarily tell my mates about, like, I've got toilet issues, or like, it's one of those taboos kind of subjects. And so even presenting it as a problem would be far off the agenda. But the moment it became really unbearable pain, it was like, I need to go A&E. And so...
But even at that stage, did you ever think this could be a cancer? Can my symptoms represent something far sinister? Again, subliminally, were you concerned, or was that never even at, oh, I'm too young?
So I remember talking to colleagues saying, worst case scenario, it's cancer. But kind of dismissing that, even though there's a family history. You know, my dad died of bowel cancer when I was a baby. But that knowledge wasn't there. It was maybe a couple of years before I got my diagnosis. I was going through documentation and I found a letter that said he had transverse colon surgery in 1979, like a few years before I was born, and he subsequently died from the disease. Like, I had that knowledge, and so when I went in with the pain to A&E, I mentioned, oh, by the way, my dad died of bowel cancer. And he said, yeah, we need to put some cameras inside to see what's going on. But even at that point, I didn't think it was cancer, because I was, in my head, I was fit and healthy. I was eating well. I, you know, one of my colleagues would tease me with the mantra, my body is a temple, because, you know, that's how I kind of looked after myself. And so it was so far away from what I thought it would be. You know?
And Nero, from your experience as a colorectal surgeon, and when you have treated the young patients, when that information is given and the news is given, do you see that sort of that ignorance of what it is, and was cancer so far from their minds of what it was? Or do you think there's been a change in an awareness of, you know, patients have that within their sort of mindset that this could be something sinister. What's your experience been about just the awareness of its presence and its risk?
I see a real mix in that. I think there's a lot of patients who've been through some medical professionals before they get to us, and it's been flagged to them as there's a family history, and that term being used again and again puts the idea in their head that there may be an association and there's something to be concerned about. I think some patients just bring themselves in if they've moved and realised that they should have been screened due to similar sort of thing, a parent at an early age with a diagnosis, and they put themselves in for screening. But then you do also get patients who obviously have no idea of that, and it's never been flagged because, of course, we didn't know as much as we do now about inheritable forms of cancer, things like Lynch syndrome, for example, which weren't routinely tested for, you know, even as early as 20, 30 years ago, but now it's much more routine practice. So even if it doesn't necessarily change that patient's outcome, we can at least survey and screen the family and make them aware of what they need to be looking out for.
And on that then, looking what to look out for, you know, what, just for the education of the people listening, what are the common symptoms of sort of bowel cancer? So if we separate it out from general bowel, and then we'll talk about a subset of colorectal cancer and rectal cancer.
Sure.
Perhaps you can just shed some light on the typical presentations.
Sure. So there's a difference, of course, between how people present and things that doctors might pick up on. So in terms of things that people present with, it tends to be a change in bowel habit, and that could be in either direction. So it may move towards constipation or diarrhea, but it's a change that persists for more than a few weeks. If people have any sort of systemic changes, like a drastic weight loss, again, that can be a pointer towards something being wrong in the GI tract. Bleeding can be a feature in any sort of bowel cancer, but particularly with colonic cancer rather than rectal cancer, it may be that it's a altered blood, which, and by that we mean darker blood, not necessarily
blood in the poo.
In the poo. So it may be mixed in with the poo, and it might be darker than usual, darker than you'd expect it to be. It can just be abdominal pain. People might even notice a lump or a mass in their abdomen that's grown over time. So any number of these things tends to point people towards coming to see the doctor. Then aside from that, there are things that the doctor might notice when assessing the patients, like a change in their hemoglobin level. So if they're anemic, that can be a pointer towards investigating them as well.
Sure. And Mohammed, probably nice segue into your particular, a segue into your journey.
So I think the ultimate pain that took me to A&E was a pain in the upper left quadrant of my abs. And the pain was so bad that it was there the whole night, so intensify. And it was just, I can't explain how intense it was. Now, before that, the pain would come and go. So it would be in meetings and then it would go. And then maybe a couple of years before that, there was a period where my bowel habits had completely changed. So it was very loose. And I did go to the GP at that stage with the complaints. And it was an investigation for like a number of weeks. But then it became normal again. So there wasn't a need to go back. So we thought whatever it was, the bug had gone. And only now, in hindsight, I can kind of trace it back to actually maybe there was something more, you know, we use the word sinister. Maybe there was, even though I presented myself. But when it became unbearable, it was just pain. The bowel habits, yes, sometimes it was loose, sometimes it was solid. I didn't see any blood. I didn't feel a lump. But what I would say is after I had gone into the machine to find out what was going wrong, it was multiple trips to the GP. They did find my iron levels were really low, so the hemoglobin, so the, levels, the, is it red blood cells?
That's right.
Yeah, they were really low. So, but then my GP asked, had I lost any weight? And it was only when I stepped onto the scale, I realized, oh my God, the signs were there. Because, you know, I was 62 kilograms. Every time I'd go to the gym on the treadmill, I'd punch in, I'm 62 kilograms. And all of a sudden, I'm 57. And that's like a 5 kilogram drop, which is, I think, is huge when you're not wanting to lose weight. But the sign was there in that my jeans were loose. Where I never needed to use a belt, I was using a belt, but it just didn't register like why I'm needing to use it. I was so oblivious to it. And
Mo, so if we take you back to that period where you're in intense pain,
mm-hmm.
what do you think, again, this all hindsight, stopped you going back to your GP and saying, hey, look, something's not right? What do you think were the variables that made you make that decision of, was it you being assured that you'd been tested before? What do you think it was?
No, I mean, I did keep going back. At that point, it was a case of the pain isn't going. So they gave me antibiotics, they gave me iron tablets. And I was told I'm in the system to get a colonoscopy. But I kept presenting myself every week until, so from the moment I went A&E to the moment I had the cameras, it was 6 weeks. That was how long I had to wait. Now in my head, I'm like, why is it taking so long? But apparently 6 weeks is a short time. I don't know from a clinical perspective if that is or not. But for me, it was like, why am I even waiting 6 weeks for this? Why can't I just go in tomorrow and get these cameras done? And so...
So it's clear here, Neera, that, you know, you clearly wasn't referred as a 2 week wait, or the cancer certainly wasn't a suspicion from what the story most giving us. Again, are you seeing that sort of, do you think the young age is almost being falsely safety netted with these patients, that or there's nothing sinister?
So I'd say less and less so, but yes, we have seen that happen a lot. I think it's typically not at most people's foremind, as it were, that when you see a young patient in front of you that this is likely to be a cancer, and there's a whole bunch of benign conditions that are far more likely to be. And we're programmed in medical school to go through a sort of sieve of what's the most likely thing. But at the same time, obviously, it has to be there in the back of your head that this is a possibility, and there are other clues in your background that would make one allude to the fact that there's a family history, you've got quite a few of the symptoms, etc. So typically now, I think most people in primary care do tend to refer most colorectal symptoms that fit the 2 week wait pathway, which we've made very open now, through that pathway. So the majority of patients that we see are referred on a 2 week wait pathway.
And on the proportion of those that you see, how many of those are you seeing in the under 40s where the cancer is kind of put there as a differential?
So it's difficult. They tick a box usually when they refer to say that the patient is aware that they're being diagnosed as a possible on this pathway. What goes hand in hand with that conversation, I'm not sure, because I think usually there'd be the feeling from primary care GP to try and reassure the patient, so they'll probably say, it's unlikely, but I'm going to put you through this pathway so you get your test done quickly. So now typically it still take not much less than that, about 2 weeks to see a doctor as a maximum, hopefully, and then another 2 weeks potentially to get your colonoscopy. Can be quicker, so we're trying to get patients seen within a few days, or at least triaged within a few days now. And there's sort of a 28-day pathway so that you get the patient from the point of referral to being able to see a doctor or a nurse and go through a triage system and have all their tests done and reported. So,
but from your sort of top of the head look at the work you've been doing over the last few years, have you seen a reduction in the age of the types of people who are being put on the 2 week wait pathways, or do you still think it's more weighted towards over 50s, over 60s? Are you seeing some signal that GPs are classifying of a potential cancer in the younger age groups?
certainly seen that far younger patients are being referred in the 2E rate pathway. There are still obviously those people that have been put through a benign pathway or a routine pathway, and very, very few of them are elderly, so there's still some bias. And I think more of the young patients get put through with fresh anorectal bleeding on that pathway on the assumption that it's more likely to be hemorrhoids or a fissure. But in terms of the vast majority do come through the 2-week weight pathway now, so certainly far younger patients as well.
You are seeing them. So I thought I'd mention my own sort of, so I am a colorectal trainee from the past, so I know all the, a lot of what you're saying. But despite that, about 3 years ago, I developed some rectal bleeding. And you know, you sort of, even as a specialist, you think it's probably just hemorrhoids, and you know, you try to positively associate things that aren't really there. And I went forward, colonoscopy, it was all clear. But then even in someone who knows, in myself, there's a reluctance to move forward, not because I'm embarrassed by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess there's a fear of colonoscopy. Yes. So I thought let's speak about colonoscopy. What is it? How uncomfortable is it? And what's its value? So perhaps we'll talk Neera first, and then Mo, I'd love to hear your experiences with a colonoscopy, and if you're really lucky, I'll share mine. But Neera, what is a colonoscopy? Why is it important, and how is it done?
Sure. So colonoscopy is a video camera, essentially, passed on a tube around the bowel. So your bowel is quite loopy, and it needs to be expanded so we don't miss anything. There are lots of folds in the bowel, so little things like polyps and even small tumours can hide and lurk behind them. So in blowing up the bowel, it does cause some cramping, pain, discomfort. So we generally tend to give patients sedation and some pain relief during that procedure. Some patients opt not to have it so that they can get themselves home without being driven. But for the most part, the majority take some sedation just to make them a little bit drowsy. It doesn't put them to sleep completely, as we may need the patient to move from side to side to get around the corners in their bowel. In terms of the discomfort, we do give them some pain relief as well. Everyone is very subjective in terms of how they manifest pain. So, you know, some patients just seem to fly through the procedure extremely comfortably and no problem at all. Some people have far more sensitive bowels, and we know that this can change at different stages in life and also at different stages even in someone's cycle, for example. So in terms of sensitivity, it is really variable, and people do have different experiences. Some people say that the bowel prep they take before the procedure.
Yeah, let's talk about the bowel prep. You know, what is bowel prep?
Sure.
Describe what that is. I'll take my experience with bowel prep.
So bowel prep is something that's given before the procedure, essentially to flush your large bowel out. Generally, if we try and put a camera around, we're just going to see a lot of feces and we would miss an awful lot of pathology. So in order to try and avoid that and give you the best result, we try and encourage the patient just to drink fluids the day before and to have a bowel prep, which really is a strong, strong laxative. So it tends to put you on the toilet most of the day before the procedure, and possibly, unfortunately, the night before the procedure too. So generally when patients come in, they'll be pretty knackered. But at the same time, it does give them the best chance of having a clean bowel, which means the best chance of avoiding missing any cancers or polyps that need to be picked up.
Okay, so you're best friends with the toilet the night before.
Absolutely.
And in the morning, you travel to this place, you have sedation if you require. How long does it take?
So that, again, varies depending on how long someone's colon is, if they've had surgery before, and generally, on average, I'd say about 20 minutes to half an hour. If you find polyps or things need to be removed, it can take a bit longer than that.
Okay. How safe is it?
So it's very safe generally. We tend to quote figures of risk that include things like the risk of bleeding after the procedure, more likely if you've had a polypectomy, the removal of a polyp or little growth at the time. It can also have a risk of perforating, which means making a hole in the bowel. Now, this is rare, but if it happens, it's serious because then you need an operation to fix it most of the time. If you have a perforation, there's a risk of needing quite a major emergency surgery, so you'd have to be admitted and you'd need to potentially wear a bag, a stoma bag. The risk is low, so we tend to quote a figure of 1 in 1,000 for colonoscopy. Visualizing what's there, not missing flat lesions, which may only appear on a camera, which wouldn't necessarily appear on a scan. And it is also the only way that we have at the moment of taking a biopsy, taking a piece of the tissue to send it to the lab and actually work out, is this a cancer? Is this something benign that we don't have to worry as much about? In terms of other tests, though, there's a shorter test called the flexible sigmoidoscopy. This is less uncomfortable and a lower risk of perforating. It gives us a lot of this information, and it really only surveys the left side of the bowel. But that is where the majority of the cancers are picked up from, so there's a reasonably good pickup rate. And then the rest of the bowel can be surveyed with different tests. So there is a plain CT scan with contrast, which gives you an indication of bigger lesions, but it can miss small things quite easily. And then there's another test, which is a sort of combination, as it were, called a CT colonography, or some people call it a virtual colonoscopy. With that, you still have a CT scan. They tend to give you something to empty your bowel, so they still usually give you a bowel prep. But if you're not really suitable for a bowel prep for any reason, they can give you something to drink called gastrographin, which will stain all the feces, and they can digitally subtract that from your image. So that still gives you some indication of whether there's any tumor lurking there, without having to go through a full bowel prep, but it will still give you a slight laxative effect.
And relative to the gold standard, how accurate are scans to sort of rule in or rule out cancer?
So people talk generally about a 10% miss rate. So I think essentially if people are very high risk and if there's a way of obtaining a colonoscopy safely, we tend to still defer to that as the gold standard unless there's a physical reason they can't have it. Either they've tried before and it's failed because they weren't able to get around the colon, the endoscopist, or the patient found it intolerable themselves. Or if they've got, there's a few other reasons that a patient may choose not to. Occasionally they may suggest a deeper level of sedation like propofol or a general anaesthetic, but they aren't routinely available in the NHS because of resources. So for the most part, then they would suggest either a flexible sigmoidoscopy with a CT scan or a CT colonography. But they're both ways that you can image the whole bowel.
Sure. So Mo, back onto your experiences of I assume you had a colonoscopy at some stage when you were diagnosed?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about your experience from the patient's perspective.
Yeah, so I was actually petrified of having a colonoscopy. Mm. And that came from seeing my mother have a colonoscopy a few years earlier. And it was the bowel prep, seeing her needing to run to the toilet just like the evening before. And that image was what was most...
So it was the prep?
That the perception of how bad the prep's going to be was what was terrifying for me. And so that was partly something I was anxious. So my experience of the colonoscopy may not be typical.
Sure.
But I guess it's an example of what happens if you do the colonoscopy too late. The pain, because I think they put air through.
That's right.
To allow the camera to kind of go through the bowel, but that was pressing against the mass that was there, or the tumor that was there, and it was so painful. And I had one experiences of those without any sedation, and it was 5 minutes. It doesn't last long, but I was just sweating, and it was like so horrible. The second time I had it, I'm like, I need some kind of sedation, and then they offered me gas in it, and that kind of made me high, and I didn't feel
it's
anything.
Brilliant stuff, isn't it?
Yes, and so
I'll tell you.
So if anyone's going for a flexi, do opt for the gas and
the
air.
Gas and
it stops the irritation or the pain.
Well, just to balance things out then, I must speak about my colonoscopy experiences because they weren't as bad. So I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, and I wanted the best pair of hands doing my scope. And I found Dr. Alani, shout out Dr. Alani, and I said, I want a scope. So the bowel prep for me was an inconvenience, but tolerable. And I've been put off the lemonade, the flavouring they do. It reminds me of that experience. But my scope was very, very, I took the gas in. I didn't want to be sedated because I wanted to see the screen as to what he was seeing at the time. But I think I was done within 5 minutes because they went round. I had pretty straight bowel, went all the way around. And there's an embarrassment there because I knew some of the people in the room. I wanted to cover my bits. It's the most, you're there, you're exposed. It's undignified. But my experience, once it's in, as in the first bit, you think, right, well, you know, let's get serious now. Why are we here? Went all the way around, and as soon as it was finished, you think, is that it? As in, it was, I'd worked myself up into, it's going to be a lot worse than it was. Thankfully, it wasn't anything sinister. In fact, it was nothing. I got told I wasted his time. But for my experiences, certainly, the build-up, the embarrassment, and the bowel prep is far worse than the actual scope itself. But, you know, I went to someone very, very experienced. So I thought I must throw in the mix there that not all experiences. I don't know, Nero, whether you've had a scope yet?
Not yet. Not yet. Probably will in a few years, just from choice. Well, I think maybe because I'm skewed because of the number of young cancers I see, I probably would soon.
You remember them, yeah, yeah.
but no, I haven't had the pleasure yet.
So that's the scope. So that's one of the barriers. And Mo, love to hear more about your journey from diagnosis. Now, you mentioned stage 4, just to for our listeners to as to what that means. So perhaps Nero, you can talk about the stages of cancer.
Sure.
What does 1 mean? What does 4 mean? And then we can go back to Mo, so he can explain his journey.
Sure. So starting with what Mo had, stage 4, that means that it's quite an advanced form of cancer. And it's actually spread to other organs distant from where the cancer itself resides. So typically with bowel cancer, it tends to go to the liver, it tends to go to the lung most commonly. It can go to other places as well, but that's less common. Stage 3, the one before, it means it's gone to the lymph nodes. Now typically we tend to pick that up more after we've operated, because when we send the tumor away to the lab, we send off a packet of tissue that incorporates lymph nodes, and they get looked at under the microscope. And then, you know, on the scan, they may look enlarged anyway, but they can only sort of half guess on the scan as to whether they're involved or not. So once we've removed them, they usually let us know. Stage 1 and 2 are the earlier forms. Stage 1 is when it hasn't gone through the muscle wall, and stage 2 when it has gone through the muscle wall. When I say the muscle wall, the bowel has multiple layers. There's a layer of muscle. And we look at different types of staging according to which layers have been penetrated. And obviously the further it's gone from the inner lining, which is where the tumor originates from, the more advanced it is. But it's all very treatable at that stage, though.
At 1 and 2?
Yeah.
So if we were to put some numbers out there, if I've got a stage 1 cancer, what's my survival versus a stage 4?
Sure. So with stage 1, it's extremely good. Assuming it's caught and it's treated, we'd be looking at 5-year survival of over 90%.
So that means the proportion of people alive at 5 years, about 90%, we've got stage 1. And stage 4?
So with stage 4, the numbers aren't so good. And again, figures that we've seen tend to be from a few years back. I think we tend to treat tumours a lot more aggressively now, and certainly even now we're still progressing in terms of doing resections of liver, resections of lung, for everything that is removable. And we've shown that if you can actually resect all the disease that's, well, all the elements involved with the tumour, with clear margins, you could potentially give someone a 50% chance of survival at 5 years. That's not always the case. Of course, a lot of the time it's very advanced at the time of pickup. And if it isn't all resectable disease, or the patient isn't fit enough to have such huge surgeries, then really you're looking at a very poor survival outcome at stage 4. And we'd probably be putting a number down to approximately 10-20%.
Sure, okay. And for something to go from stage 1 to 4, What's the typical time frame?
So again, this is something that I think is really age critical. So we tend to say that most tumours in the over 60s group tend to be more slow growing, and it's usually over a period of years, typically perhaps 2 to 5 years. But I think with younger patients, we see much more aggressive disease. And it's difficult because, of course, we catch them at a point and we've only seen them at a snapshot in time, so we don't see the progression. Mm-hmm. But typically, we tend to see much worse disease in young people, often because I think some of their repair mechanisms, as it were, don't work as well as they do in other people. So I think their tumours can be more aggressive and grow faster.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. So back to you, Mo. So, you know, it sounds like you beat the odds, and look, it's an inspiration that, you know, you have. How did you, so tell us about your journey to when you get told you've got stage four. Someone tells you the reality of what that means with respect to survival. Tell me about your mindset, what you were thinking, and how you overcame it.
Yeah, so going in to the consultation with my doctor, in my head I've got the words, it's either cancer or Crohn's, because that is what the, what do you call the
endoscopist,
yeah, that's what they left me with, because they didn't probably want to tell me it was cancer without the confirmation there. And so in my head, worst case scenario was the cancer, best case scenario is Crohn's. So I had a level of, okay, hoping for the best, was still pretty bad. But the moment he said, yes, it's cancer, because he wasn't sure what I had known. And so he asked me, what did they tell you? And it was verbatim, word for word, the way I was told, and he was like, yes, it's cancer. And then in that moment, everything was just still, everything just stopped. At the same time, my background was in personal development, which was all about having a positive mindset, and, you know, whatever challenges there are, you can work through. And so I had this psychology which I'd been working on for over 10 years. So in that moment, I'm like, I need to use every ounce of that to get through whatever is ahead of me, not yet knowing what was in store. I was told it's inoperable. It was the surgeon I actually met. So he didn't know from an oncology perspective what their opinion was going to be, but from a surgeon's perspective, he was like, it looks big and I don't think we can operate at this stage. And he was talking about, he was very positive actually, he was kind of like, in 9 months you can be back back at work with a stoma bag. And I didn't know what a stoma bag was, and so I left that particular consultation kind of like, okay, it's bad, but, you know, the surgeon seems very hopeful. It was when I met the oncologist, I realized how bad it was, because he told me it was stage four. And from the surgeon to the oncologist, it was probably a 1 week wait. So in that time, you're on Google trying to learn as much about the disease as possible, you know, learning about the staging, because I had no idea what stage one was or what stage four was. And at that point, I'm like praying, let it be stage one, let it be stage one. And so hearing it stage four, and then hearing him saying, you have a small chance of success, it kind of like that small bit of optimism I had was just gone. And then everything just happened so quickly. It was chemo within a week, and the chemo was a pump, which, it's kind of like, there's so many appointments you need. You need to have like a PIC line, all these terms which I didn't know, and I don't think I'll be any good at explaining, but they had to put a device inside of me that connects straight into my bloodstream, the veins, so that the medication they give can go straight in into my system. And so I had 6 cycles of this chemo, which took 12 weeks. Every 2 weeks I needed it. And I went in for a CT scan to see an update, to see what the progress was. I went in for the CT scan. I came home. I was about to lie on the couch from the fatigue when I get a call from the hospital saying, we think you've got a blood clot in your lungs. We need you to come in straight away. And like, that was terrifying, because you hear of blood clots and people dying from them, and I'm like, what now? And so I had to go to A&E, the technical term they call a pulmonary embolism. And I was in the hospital for a week because they were checking my fluids, they were checking my bloods. And but while I'm in hospital, I got the CT scan update, and one of the oncologists came and said it was positive.
Despite the clot,
the tumor,
I have some good news.
The tumor has shrunk a little bit, allowing me to be put forward to the surgical team. And I'm like, okay, that's something else to worry about. And I then ended up having surgery, and the day of the build up to surgery was signing consent. So we're going to take out your entire colon. You're going to have a stoma bag, which will collect your poo. We might need to take out your stomach. We might need to take out your abdominal wall. We might need to take out your spleen. And I'm just signing off every single body part, it felt, not knowing what I'm going to be left with. But, you know, that is what was ahead of me. And surgery went really well. At that point, everyone was hopeful. It was like the positivity that the surgeon originally had was there again. So they gave me mop-up chemo. So another six cycles of the chemotherapy. And I had that. And I actually did go back to work.
Whilst you're having the chemo?
Straight after the second lot of chemo. And so I thought everything's going to be well again. And I've beat the odds, or whatever the odds were. But it was the next set of scans where I was expecting the oncologist to say, you're all well, but it was bad news, which I wasn't prepared for. I relapsed while on chemo, and during that time the geneticists came back with Lynch syndrome confirmation, where my dad died of bowel cancer. And so my bowel cancer was hereditary, and they had that confirmation from the bloods that they took and the genetic sequencing, which then meant whatever treatment was given to me wasn't optimal. The research was still new at the time for immunotherapy, and we're talking 2015, but that wasn't available on the NHS. It wasn't available on any clinical trial either. So they gave me second line chemo, as that was next best, knowing that it may not actually work. And so I in a space of a year, I had 18 cycles of chemo. I had the surgery. I had a blood clot in my lungs, all the side effects, to then hear, there's nothing else we can do for you. You know, the chemo's not working, the cancer's growing, and our options are all gone. And I was actually prepared to hear that. When I went in, it was kind of like, okay, what's the worst case scenario? And my question was, okay, you mentioned Lynch syndrome and you mentioned immunotherapy. How do I get this? How do I pay for it? And they were like, you need to be a millionaire. And it was like, okay, that plan's not going to work. But they were still hopeful. They were like, okay, we can put in a special application to the NHS for funding. I think I can't even remember what it's called now. An individual
funding request.
Individual funding request. And they forwarded me to the Sarah Cannon Research Institute, where they were hoping for a new immunotherapy clinical trial that I would be a candidate for. And so there were still options, even though it was worst case scenario and nothing else available, there was still a bit of hope. And so I went in hopeful, but then it became about waiting for the NHS. They came back 3 months later with a note. The clinical trials, they weren't actually looking for patients who have had treatment. They were looking for first line patients. So, you know, clinical trials are so hard sometimes to qualify for. And I didn't qualify for it. And so we then tried the drug companies for compassionate use. They too said no. They were like, there's a license for it. It can be used if you can pay for it. It's there. And at that point, hope had gone. And one of my friends, he was like, let's raise money for it. And his words were, even if we raise 5,000, we're doing something. Let's just do something. But to go from his words to actually saying yes, that was an entirely different journey altogether, because you're processing self-worth and, you know, am I worth it? Like, going out to fundraise for yourself is like, for me, was one of the most difficult decisions I had to make, because the trajectory was one of death, ultimately. And then it was a case of how much. So some of the quotes were like 20,000 for one cycle, but we then worked it down to around 10,000 a cycle quoted. And then we end up having a figure of £200,000 to raise to save my life. And when the moment I said yes, it was a case of, okay, I'm going to do absolutely everything I possibly can. Because part of my thinking was, if I die without this treatment or without trying this treatment, what am my family going to be left with the question, what would have happened if he had it? Like, that was what was going in my mind. And so it was kind of, let's try getting this. And it was incredible. We raised the money and I had the treatment and it worked. Like, the research showed people with Lynch syndrome, or like, we can go into the technicalities, but
we will. We'll definitely, yeah, just get a brief update on what Lynch is from there.
People with Lynch syndrome, or the right genetics, getting immunotherapy, the data I saw had close to 80% response rate, which is high. And it was pretty much textbook. That's what happened. Within the first four cycles, there was a dramatic reduction in the size of the tumors, 40% reduction, 30% reduction in all my lymph nodes. I went on to have a year of the immunotherapy. Because we had to self-fund my oncologist, who was in fact the director of the Sarah Cannon Research Institute, he was seeing the data in real time from clinical trials, and he was saying, okay, we're stopping treatment with some of our patients and they're still responding, so let's do that with you. So after a year, I was what he called a watch and wait. So I had scans every 8 weeks and the results were good, to the point where one of the scans showed no evidence of disease, and it was like, I wasn't anticipating that. And I'm here all these years later, and it's a miracle that I'm still alive. We talked about the data showing stage four survival rates are really not good compared to stage one, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the latest advances in treatment, in screening, in therapy. Like, if it wasn't for that drug, you know, the baseline scan before the immunotherapy started was showing signs of spreading into the liver, showing signs of spreading into the spleen, the lymph nodes continuing to grow, to then having no evidence of disease, it's incredible.
Well, that's amazing to hear, and And again, well done. Congratulations on the journey you've been through. And Nehru, I guess it's appropriate to ask you very briefly, to the non-expert, what is Lynch syndrome? How do I know if I've got it or not? And specifically about the latest sort of treatments like immunotherapy, what are they? And is that still current, where getting access to these sort of novel agents is still challenging?
Sure. So keeping it at a fairly simple level, it's an inherited form of cancer. Most cancers are sporadic. Most cancers, unfortunately, just happen to people, but a fairly small proportion can be familial or inherited. Lynch syndrome is one that we're increasingly aware of, really, over the last, I'd say, last decade or so. And it's not just bowel cancer, but it can actually predispose to other types of cancer as well. So particularly those in the renal tract and those in the gynae tract. So for the most part, we wouldn't know if we had it or not unless someone in our family had already had a bowel cancer or one of these other cancers, and it was picked up from the histology. So when it gets removed, it's sent to the lab, and whilst they tended to only screen young people under the age of 50, perhaps 5-10 years ago, now we tend to run the test on everyone. So it's more widely available. Certainly in our area, we test everyone for this. And partly so we know whether people are going to be sensitive to chemotherapy afterwards, because it's been shown with Lynch syndrome, they're not so sensitive to chemotherapy, but then there are other treatments like immunotherapy that can be offered. And partly so that we can suggest appropriate screening to the rest of the family, but then we would send them for genetic studies to a specialist centre, and they then obviously do all the contact tracing and let them know to search out the appropriate screening.
Sure. And on the treatments, this immunotherapy, are there updates and access? And
so that is still a challenge, to be honest. I don't know the details myself. I tend to go to our oncologist to find out the information in terms of whether patients would be suitable or not.
Mom?
Yes, so there are still challenges, but there was a breakthrough last year. I was part of the NHS appraisal that went to NICE, who make decisions on drug availability, and for bowel cancers with Lynch and MSI, microsatellite instability, there is now a pathway to get immunotherapy as first line and as someone who's previously had treatment. So those changes came last year, in the middle of last year, that they got approval. So, you know, as the research is coming out and as, you know, more and more companies are producing immunotherapy, that costs is a huge factor. And so, you know, the day that they said yes, it was like, you know, thankful that, you know, I was a small part of that story to potentially save people's lives.
And Mo, you said something, reflecting back on what you said in your story, and it kind of stuck out to me, is that you were waiting, you'd done your Google searches, you had an idea what stage one and stage four was, and you almost wished that it was a stage one versus a stage four. And I think both Nero and I can confirm that potentially likely of someone going through what you went through at stage one is very unlikely relative to stage four. What do you think the take-home message is of those people who have symptoms now as they listen to this podcast?
If you've got symptoms, to actually take it seriously. And you might get pushback. So going to the GP and talking about some of those early symptoms, it's easy to get dismissed as irritable bowel syndrome. And, you know, that would be good in a work like to from it becoming a stage one, you know, you'd prefer it to be IBS or IBD. But you need to kind of be a champion for yourself. It's quite challenging. The model of medicine we have is the doctor knows best. And And that's because, you know, they've trained for several years to have that expertise. But sometimes we know our bodies and we know, you know, it's not right. And so I know Bowel Cancer UK, the charity, have created a symptoms diary, which you can download from the from their website, and, you know, make notes of, on a Monday, you know, my bowel habits were good. On a Tuesday, they weren't. Like, to just have as much detail as possible, you know, is there blood, is there constipation, is there a pain, have you lost weight? So knowing the signs is one thing, and then actually following the signs is another, and keeping track of them. And so going to a doctor with 3 weeks worth of data of, you know, is more powerful than actually going and saying, I've got pain. Like, so taking kind of initiative and being, feel empowered to actually have the conversation with the doctors to not get dismissed. And I say that because I've heard from so many people who have got the signs and the symptoms, and they're not being forwarded to a colorectal specialist, or they're not getting the screening. They're just, you know, you're too young.
And Nero, that's certainly a variable that contributes to late diagnosis, as you know, poor triage at the time of first presentation. But what do you think are the other variables? I mean, I'm trying to go step back all the way into the mindset of that patient who has symptoms. And what do you think some of those variables are that stops them presenting to anybody?
So I think there's a lot of things involved. One, certainly, as you mentioned, just the whole, you know, you probably get told again and again by different doctors, oh, you're too young, it's hemorrhoids, it's something benign. And that starts to play a factor in your thinking. You think, well, they know what they're talking about. It's not, and statistically, that's the case, but you can't go completely on statistics. And similarly, it's drummed into us, as you know, that, you know, 90% of the diagnosis is in the history taking. And if you go into the detail, and if you have that much detail being presented, one, it highlights the fact that the patient is really worried about something. And of course, some people worry more than others, but they're really going into that level of detail to keep a diary of their symptoms, so they have symptoms. Similarly, it might come from not necessarily the patient presenting, it might be from a family member, it could be from a concerned mother or a wife or a partner or a child. So again, if the family are presenting with real concerns, again, it's something not to be taken lightly, and it's important to get all that sort of collateral history into your thought process. I think other things, we mentioned being BAME. So I think there's a real cultural feel in many places that there tends to be a feeling that the doctor knows best, as you mentioned as well. And I think that's very strongly highlighted in certain cultures, to the point where they're just not questioned at all. And I think to a degree, certainly in areas where there's high incidences of BAME patients, that plays a role. I think there's also just a sort of, as we said earlier in the discussion, this reluctance to talk about bowel symptoms and it being regarded as a taboo subject. So a lot of people, though they might be scared, often just tend to bury it and try not to think about it, talk about it. And by the time they then do present, they often find that it's too late, unfortunately, or are told that it's too late at that stage. So I think that's another factor. People have concerns, especially if they're, you know, depending on their financial positions, if they're self-employed, sometimes they feel like they need to work, and if they're going to need surgery, that's going to impact on their ability to provide. So again, there are a number of factors like that that play a role. So I think depending on the local demographics in the area, both from primary and secondary care point of view, it's sort of very much seen that there is an impact in how late the presentation is in certain areas over others.
Absolutely. And I just thought we'd mention what we've done at Surgees is that we're well aware of this problem in timely access to diagnostics. And what we did is we created a smaller type of device called a sort of a Lumini, that's a camera, like a mini colonoscopy, It doesn't look at all of the bowel, but it looks at certainly the most one of the most common sites for when you do get cancer. And the device is connected to a kind of a platform that allows you to dial in people at Nero in real time. And we have a hypothesis that making it more timely, improving the access, and getting an immediate test. So if you go with symptoms, you're not being sent away. You're not being given a test fit. You're saying, okay, well, get on the couch. I'm going to look at your bottom. That we think is going to have two effects, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. That the first effect is once you have a camera at your bottom, you've gone effectively through the worst case scenario. You've now almost to a point been desensitized to think, okay, well, I've survived that, and you know, I've kind of understand what the game is, the narrative is. And B, we actually think we'll pick up cancers. We ran a small trial, about 114 patients, where we delivered this technology in the community, and we picked up two cancers in those patients that wouldn't necessarily have been referred. So that's what our mantra is. But from your perspective, you know, if you turn up to these, to your GP, and the GP says, actually, fine, get on the couch, mm-hmm. and we're about to test you for the most common site. Well, how do you think that would sit with, first, yourself, and secondly, in patients who are probably... who are in your position, who have symptoms but no formal diagnosis?
Yeah, I'd definitely welcome it. I mean, going back, if that was offered to me at the time, there's no reason for me to say no. You know, I'm in pain, I want to know the reason. So if that was available, whether it would have diagnosed me or not, I don't know. But yes, that, you know, it shows, you know, that I'm being taken seriously. So just even psychologically, it's one of those, okay, I'm not kind of just being fobbed off here. Whoever is testing me is actually, you know, caring for me. So, and what you mentioned about finding two people with the cancer, that's incredible. Like, who wouldn't ordinarily have got that information so quickly, right?
Yeah, well, it was actually two cancers and 10 polyps. So polyps are precursors to cancer. Yeah. So the pickup rate was, you know, we were very proud when we ran that trial. But really, we can build the technologies, but we have to change the mindsets. We have to increase the awareness for the people to come through. I must say, from our experience, the NHS were a little slow to adopt, particularly in that sort of tier of care, in primary care. What do you think needs to change, Nero, for these types of diagnostics to be better triaged and sort of assessed by the NHS and adopted? What do you think needs to change? Do you think there's a problem in innovation uptake in the NHS?
I think it will be an interesting shift in terms of training in primary care, because it's not a million miles from what we do in our daily routine anyway, in terms of seeing patients in clinic. And unfortunately for them, popping things up their bottom to have a look. So it's in a way almost par for the course for us. But for general practitioners that obviously have constraints on the time that they have to see a patient, they may need to get through more than one complaint from a patient. They may go with a few things to talk about. It can be a more pressurized system in a way. But I think from the point of view of increasing access, it's going to be an education piece partly. I mean, obviously GPs are aware of colorectal cancer, but it's more in terms of if you've got a patient who potentially has hemorrhoids but you're a little bit concerned in terms of whether it's anything else or not, even if they're not all able to do it, but if a percentage of them or a group of them are able to do it in a sort of centralized hub, for example, then it might be something that the patient's willing to have done, one, to allay any concerns or fears that they have, two, if it tells them that they have got hemorrhoids, then they know that, of course, that can miss other things upstream, so it still needs a test to be done. Mm. But it at least gives them some indication.
You capture them. You've yeah. got them. You can then send them on for other tests.
Absolutely.
So more finally then, so we've you know, really gone through all of the topics, is... You know, you continue to be an inspiration to others from your story. Tell us about what you're doing currently. You know, what journey, what stage of journey you're on. What's part of your campaign, your personal campaign? Are you involved in anything?
I've discovered this movement therapy, and I'm learning it. So that takes up some of my time, but I'm also in the sphere of diversity and inclusion. So I'm a keynote speaker, talks about diversity and inclusion. And one of the projects I'm working on at the moment is around creating a network for people to kind of come together and share and learn and support each other who are invested in the area of diversity and inclusion. So those kind of projects keep me busy. And then outside of those, I do get involved with like campaigning on cancer access. So I've done a number of pieces of work with the NHS. We spoke earlier about immunotherapy and getting access to within the NHS. Bowel Cancer UK is a charity that I've done a lot of work with, trying to, you know, get Lynch syndrome out there in public discourse, and just trying to raise as much awareness as possible. You know, I documented my story in a book, which I've got here.
Yeah, please do. Called, yes, yes.
It's called Choosing to Stay, where I share my story and I present it as, you know, the choices I had to make along the way. So the moment I had to choose to say yes to life was saying, yes, let's fundraise. And, you know, I also, in part two of the book, talk about some of the biggest lessons I learned through the experience. And so, you know, I, to still be alive, it's pretty surreal to look back and, you know, talk about all the, like, those really dark moments which we've not gone into, to still be here, it's very surreal. And yeah, it's something. There's a gap there. What do you do at the end of the cancer experience? Like, you go through what I've gone through, and it was an ordeal, and I'm still alive, and it's like, now what? And so I've kept myself busy with projects and choosing certain campaigns to get involved with, and, you know, to just do my best each day.
Well, thank you for having or allowing us to hear and be part of our campaign. Nira, I suspect you don't have a book that you want to talk about, but I hear you do a great deal of good work at your hospital in Barking. Perhaps you can just share some of the great work you're doing in terms of the types of surgeries you're doing.
Sure,
some
thank
of the
you.
Technologies you have, you know, not as a
nothing as inspirational.
Nothing
as yours.
I'm sure.
But saving lives.
Yeah. But no, in terms of the work, I've been a consultant for just over 5 years at Barking, Havering and Redbridge, two main hospital sites, Queen's and King George's. So we've introduced robotic surgery over the last 2 years. We're already doing keyhole surgery, but robotic surgery, we think, is just the next advance in terms of really just improving the patient journey, quicker recoveries, less blood loss, and less pain, hopefully. So we're just really looking into our early data with that. We do complex cancers as well, so things like pelvic exenteration, where the cancers have gone further than the bowel itself and potentially entered into uterus, into the bladder, into the prostate, and they need multiple teams involved in their surgery. So we've got a really good team put together with urologists, plastic surgeons, neurosurgeons, and gyne-oncology, so that enables us to do that type of work. And we're starting HIPEC, which is intraoperative chemotherapy, so for patients who have relapsed later on, if it's less than 4 or 5 sites of disease, we do some scans to look at whether it's actually still resectable. And if it is resectable, we look at whether we can introduce chemotherapy if it's going to be deemed to be of benefit by the oncologist at the time of surgery, so that we can do that at the same time.
Great stuff. So cutting edge tech in Barking.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So I guess one of the things we've done as a company is, in line with this campaign, is to take the technology I spoke about, Lumina, and actually put it within a community setting. We are doing that in Nelson in Lancashire, simply because we know the outcomes of the BAME populations in colorectal cancer are poor in that region, and the uptake from the data suggests that we don't in that region, they don't pick up or they don't take up the screening opportunity. So as part of this campaign, we are offering 300 screens for free with our device. I'll be performing some of them, and we'll be training GPs to know how to use the technology and then screen the rest. Hopefully when we leave, then that technology stays embedded within that GP practice. But as part of that campaign, we're trying to find more cancers like we did in the smaller study we did. And that's one of the things we wanted to sort of highlight within this campaign, that, you know, I don't know how much of an effect it will have, but we're confident. We just want the people who have the symptoms to turn up. So if you have rectal bleeding, if you have a change of bowel habit, and all the symptoms you Nira spoke about, to come forward. Now, chances are that's nothing sinister. So we're not saying you're coming for a cancer screen. You're coming to have your bottom checked. And it certainly doesn't give you a complete mind rest that you don't have anything higher up, as Nira said. But it sort of goes, we just want to get them in the system to explain to them that, look, it's not taboo. Talk about your poo. You can get these tests done. It's not embarrassing. It's very quick. And it gives you some level of peace of mind that there's certainly nothing in the rectum. And you've desensitized having your bottom checked, so then maybe it'll trigger them to go for a colonoscopy should they have ongoing symptoms. So that's for the next 3 months, we'll be offering that. We're trying to get to 300 people, and we really do encourage anybody with those symptoms to come forward.
So it's a bit like a rectal bleed, one-stop shop, as it were.
Absolutely. Again, we're not stressing that it's a cancer, yeah. It's a cancer service, because there's pathways for that. It's for those younger patients under 50 who wouldn't really fulfill that criteria for a two-week wait referral. So those who have itchy bottoms, painful poo, some blood, to come forward to our clinic.
So when you said it's quite quick, how long does it actually take, and how soon do people get the results?
Oh, right. It's a good question. So from the studies, it's no more longer than a standard rigid sphygmoidoscopy. So it takes between 3 minutes and 5 minutes. We do recommend you have something put up your bottom just before the test to clear everything out, or you take a suppository the morning of the test. Depending on how good that result is, we might have to repeat that. So if you factor in all that time, it's about half an hour of test, and the results are there. And the real difference here is the doctor can show the patient and say, hey, look, that's what your bottom looks like. And you'll be surprised how unicky it is. I mean, I think it's a beautiful organ, Nira, the GI tract, but I'm a bit weird. But when we're trying to demystify that area and say, look, that's what your bottom looks like inside, you get that assurance. We're trying to break down those barriers of that taboo and the invasiveness of these types of tests. So
you said it can pick up cancers, it can pick up polyps. Can it pick up anything else?
Yeah, so again, in the study that we ran, we picked up 14 IBDs, so inflammatory bowel disease, or inflammation. Okay. In your position, if we had one patient with a rectal stump only, so we looked at the rectal stump as well. So yeah, it can pick up anything that's abnormal there, we can pick up. Now, there's some very, very distal diseases, or diseases right next to your bottom, the anus. It's probably not a very good fall. That still needs a visual check, but certainly anything in the rectum is a very good device for picking up those types of diseases.
That sounds amazing.
That's some of the things we've discussed, and to our listeners, it is going to be educational, inspiring, and I hope it triggers a mindset change in those patients, so those people do have symptoms. And yeah, thank you again.
Thank you both.
It's been an honour.
Thank you.
That was great.
Thank you. Thank you.